Thank you for joining us and welcome to the 12th episode of the Guernica Accountability Podcast. Today, we'll be speaking to Maite Carrasco, documentary director and writer. In 2010, she founded Big Story Films, a scripted and non-scripted content creation for film and television. Maite comes from the world of war reporting and covered some of the most dangerous conflicts in Afghanistan, Georgia, Mali, in the Middle East, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Syria, and Iraq. Standing out for her stories since the Syrian conflict, which earned her the Iris Award from the Spanish Film and Television Academy, the Best Correspondent from the International Press Center, or the Emilio Castela Prize for the Defense of Rights and Freedoms, among other recognitions. She is a well-known lecturer in universities like Sciences Po in France. She is an expert in the Islamic world and gives talks and teach to understand the Arab world and jihadist terrorism. She's an expert in security and defense and in peace studies by the UNESCO Chair of Philosophy for Peace and has been a jury member of prestigious international documentary festivals. She's also published a number of books. In this episode, we're going to be talking to Maite about her career as a war correspondent, investigative journalism. We're going to be talking about her work in Syria and in particular at Baba Amra at the Media Center, where her and a number of other international journalists came under attack from the Syrian regime. We're also going to be talking about her documentary on the conflict in Syria and how in 2012 the attack on Baba Amra was a particular turning point in the peaceful revolution. We'll talk about propaganda and misinformation in conflict, in particular looking at Syria and Ukraine. We are joined today by Maite Carrasco, a documentary director and writer. And this morning we're going to be talking about some of the work that she's been involved with, and particularly her work in Syria. So Maite, good morning and welcome to the Guernica Accountability Podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to have the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you so much. It's an honor for me. Thank you.
So I'd like to start by asking you about how you started your career as a correspondent and then how you developed into journalism investigative work.
So I started working a long time ago in 1999 as a reporter in Almeria in the south of Spain. And from a very young age, I already liked to investigate, you know, being in the south of Europe, close to the Strait of Gibraltar. It was a place full of illicit trafficking, human trafficking, sex trafficking, drugs, etc. So for me, it was local journalism, but very rich in international and investigative stories. For example, Romanian or Russian mafias operating there. And then after in 2008, I started my career as a war correspondent properly. I was a correspondent, chief correspondent in Russia, where I worked for several media, television and written media. And when the war broke out in Georgia in the summer, I was already living in Moscow and I already spoke a little Russian. So once in Georgia, I went there and in the middle of the war, I realized that I wasn't as afraid as I thought I could be. So I remember we came across the mercenary militias that Russia let run wild, Kazakhs, Chechens, like in Ukraine now. And they were killing the population, robbing and raping women. And I remember that the cameraman were not filming them. And I had the courage to do so without them noticing. So a lot of people bought those images from me. So, and everyone told me that I was good enough to do that job. So I continued, no, because I was not scared. So I like always to go further where the perpetrators don't want us to be, where they want darkness. I think our camera puts light and they don't like that. So maybe it's my personality, which is a little bit rebel, but I like to be there and to explain the truth. So later I covered Afghanistan, Mali, the Arab Revolution started, and I saw the Mubarak and Gaddafi fall. And then I went to Syria and I thought I was going to see another dictator fall, but things there were completely different, totally different, let's say.
So we'll get to Syria in a moment and certainly the work that you're doing in Baba Amra. But it's quite a jump to go from Gibraltar to Georgia, as Georgia was the first conflict. I'm interested to know how you made the transition from documenting case of organized crime in Spain to jumping into a conflict, a very brutal conflict in Georgia.
But you know, Toby, it was by chance because I was working in Almeria, then in Barcelona, and I wanted to travel and to do something international because I love to live abroad. And I was working Euronews for a while in Lyon. And then after I went to Paris and I stayed there for 8 years and I became correspondent. And I realized how interesting it was. You know, I interviewed Le Pen in his house and I was shocked. He looked like a grandfather, you know, a tender grandfather, but he was the guy denying the Holocaust. And later I went out of Europe to jump into Russia, which is a super interesting region, Russia and you know, all the Caucasus, no? The Caucasus. And I went to Chechnya. I met Kadyrov too. And when the Georgia war started, I said to myself that it was super interesting to be there and to know because we saw what was happening before, but we didn't know that Putin was prepared to put the tanks on the ground. It was a surprise. And it was the first time that after the fall of the wall in Berlin, Russia was sending troops abroad. And now that we are assisting to the Ukrainian war, I always say in the media that we saw that before in Georgia. Putin was already the same Putin down there. So this is why I made the jump little by little. And then after Georgia, I became very interested in wars and in conflicts and in these dictators and leaders, which are putting their people into submission.
So two questions that flow from that. First of all, you have covered pretty much every conflict since you first went into Georgia. Would you say that it's almost like an addiction or a bug? You know, you get bitten by one conflict and you're drawn to other conflicts. Would you say there is a certain level of that?
You learn how to do things. It's like in any other profession. I think that when you know how to do things, you become an expert on crossing borders. You become an expert on sending very quickly breaking news. You become an expert on knowing what kind of news are credible or not. You become a little bit like you feel that you know how to do that. So and people buy your work because as a freelance that I was working and people trust you. So you feel useful when you go to those places and you feel useful because you do a good job and you feel good with yourself and also with the population you're helping because normally civilians doesn't have anyone that tells the truth and their story. As happened in Syria and Bab al-Amr. So for me, it was very, very useful. And I felt that I was doing something meaningful and something that was really good for society.
But when you were reporting in Georgia at that time, did you feel as though it was safer for journalists to report on conflict then as opposed to now?
Well, I think Georgia was the last war I covered that was a conventional war, let's say. It means that now wars changed completely. A conventional war is a war where you have the two armies and you can identify totally where are the Russians and where are the Georgians. So at that time, the front line was very clear. Later, when I went to Mali or Libya and Egypt and so on, and in Syria, of course, you realize that the war was completely different. It was a revolution. It was a civil war. It was a guerrilla war. It's a different war. So journalists are safer. I don't think so. I think we are targets because all these people that are committing crimes doesn't want us to be there. I think especially now, especially in some areas like Africa, our value is the value of our passports because we can be sold. And in other areas like the Middle East, of course, we can be shown in videos like the Islamic State does as a propaganda objects and we can be killed in front of the cameras. And this is politics for them. So we have become these targets in many ways, as it is very dangerous right now to be a journalist in the conflicts because you don't know where the enemy is. It's very difficult on the ground to know where they are, who they are, and to identify who is the person that is going to sell you, for example, your fixer, or where is exactly the front line, as in Syria or in Ukraine, for example.
Coming back to Syria and Baba Amr in particular, I saw a post that you tweeted. It was probably over a year ago now, but I remember you posting a photograph sitting in the tunnel with who I believe were two or three Syrians. And I think you were talking about the 10-year anniversary of what had happened. It's a very powerful image. How you actually decided to go into Baba Amr and how you got in and who you went in with?
Well, I entered Syria for the first time in 2012 to Al-Qusayr, which is a city close to Homs. It was January, it was very cold, it was snowing, and I remember we had come in on a motorbike from Arsal in the north of Lebanon with only one bag. And we went in with the resistance network, and then it was called the Free Syrian Army. And we spent a month with the same trousers and T-shirt, and I had room in my bag only for the filming equipment and the camera, computer, and little else. And I entered with Roberto Fraile, which is in this photo you're talking about, my cameraman who was recently killed in Burkina Faso, rest in peace, and the photographer Alessio Romenzi, which is in this photo. We are the three of us in the tunnel. And when we arrived first to Al-Qusayr, we realized that it wasn't like any other Arab revolutions and we had been. It was super different. For the first time, the people was welcoming us into their homes, putting their lives in danger. And everything was very clandestine and secret, and people were really afraid of being discovered. So let's say that not all the territory was liberated, and they had to be very, very careful, because if they were discovered with us, we could go to jail, but they would surely die in jail or be killed, as thousands of other Syrians that have died since the beginning of the war. So at that time, it was just the beginning of the civil war. There was a lot of enthusiasm. People really believed that things were going to change and so on. But you know, Toby, we didn't see any terrorists around at that time in the demonstrations. They were full of joy and hope, and it was whole families, and they really believe in a better future, in democracy and freedom and so on. So little by little, everything started to change. The repression began, and then the regime, which had had the time to prepare after seeing what happened to Gaddafi and company, started to kill them. The Shabiha, the regime militias, started killing people and displaying their corpses in the street to scare everyone and stop the revolution. And they also started shooting at the demonstrators. And this is the moment we arrived to Al-Qusayr. And then at that time, suddenly, one night, they took us to a sewer entrance, and they put us in a very, very narrow tunnel, 3 kilometers long. And they say to us, we are going to a place, a neighborhood called Baba Amr in Homs, because they're very brave workers who had risen up against the regime. And this neighborhood is surrounded by checkpoints and tanks. So the only way to get in is this tunnel. So we could at that time, we couldn't say no. It was compulsive for us to follow them, because we were alone in the middle of nowhere, and it was Al-Assad territory. So we had to go and jump into this tunnel. The tunnel was very long, really. Only one entrance at the end was 3 kilometers after you could get out in Baba Amr. So it was the only passage at that time that the resistance had to leave people coming in and out. Also people fleeing, medicines, wounded, and so on. So once inside, you know, in Baba Amr, it was a very special place. Once inside, we realized that it was super dangerous, very dangerous. I personally had not seen anything like this before. As Javier Espinosa explains in the documentary, he said that Mary Colby told him that it was one of the most dangerous places she has ever seen in her career. So we were taken to this media center, where the same place where 2 days after I left, Mary Colby and Remy Ochlik died. So this was Baba Amr. Baba Amr, if you ask me how it was, I can tell you it was like hell. People were trapped, unable to get out. It was terrible. They couldn't leave because there were snipers everywhere. And the first day we arrived, the bombs started falling one after the other from 6 in the morning until 6 in the evening. It was a real killing machine. And What we recorded there, I think, are clearly evidence of crimes against humanity, which is, I think, ultimately one of the aims of the journalism that we do. We saw mass graves, executions, massive killings. It was a massacre.
And you say it was like something you'd never seen before.
Yes, it wasn't like the Arab revolutions we saw, like Egypt or Libya. It was much worse. I mean, Homs was the first city to take up arms against the regime. It was early February 2012, and the regime wanted to put an end to it. And we saw men, women, and children dying. The armed men were too few. No weapons around. They couldn't cope with shelling. And they were without any defense. And civilians were trapped without escape. And it was really sad to see the children dying in the street because of the shelling. And as we see in the documentary, we see a father burying his daughter in the dark. They did it at night alone because they could be killed at any time by snipers. So it was really, really terrible to see those scenes, and we couldn't help them. The only way journalists could help these people is just, trying to explain the truth. I think the al-Assad regime took the decision at that time to kill them all, to besiege them and massacre them. And of course, they didn't want journalists around. They didn't want us to be around and to record this and to explain the truth.
One of the things that you talk about before is how lucky you feel that you were to have survived that when Mary Colvin and Remy Ojlik, for example, they were killed just 2 days after the photograph that you'd taken in the tunnel. Did you have a sense that because of the reporting that you were all doing at that time, you were deliberately targeted by the regime to stop the reporting?
Yeah, for sure. We can see in the documentary, as Emmanuel Daoud explains, he's a lawyer working in France, and he's leading this process, trying to find who is behind the decision of bombing the media center. And this bombing killed Mary Colvin and Remy Ojlik. And he said that he's very close to demonstrate that it was a decision behind this, a decision to sell them and to just to kill them because they were explaining the truth to the world. And they didn't manage the fact that we entered through a tunnel. They didn't know about the tunnel. So they thought they could kill everyone and the world would never know. But fortunately, we were there, and Mary Colvin and Remy Ojlik pay a big price with their lives to explain this story and other like any other colleagues that have died before doing this job. And I think this job is very important. And finally, we could get out and explain it. But the thing is, the disinformation machine of al-Assad and Putin during 10 years, they had the success to convince everyone that nothing happened there. But it happened. As Christoph Reuters from Spiegel explains in the documentary, we saw these crimes against humanity. We saw the massacre, and Mary Colvin and Remy Ojlik were there to explain this. And after 10 years, I feel like in a mission to continue to explain and to prove that the massacre of Baba Amr happened, and we saw it and we filmed it. And in this film, this documentary, The Tunnel, is a proof of crimes against humanity and a proof that 4,000 people died there. And it was the beginning of the end of the revolution, finally, because after Homs and after Baba Amr, everything changed.
And was that the main idea behind the desire to make the documentary? I'm interested in knowing if it was to tell the world the reality of what was occurring, what you were seeing in real time. Was that the main idea behind the documentary?
Yes, the main idea was to show that what happened is true, because it has been denied over and over by the regime of Bashar al-Assad, helped by the disinformation machine of Russian President Vladimir Putin. And what we recorded there are evidence of crimes against humanity, which is ultimately one of the aims of the journalism we do.
And I think it's something that is going to be there for other generations to confront the propaganda of the regime, to tell the truth. We explain the truth because we were there, we were witness of all these crimes happened. So for me, the documentary is a way to show it in pictures, in images, and to show the tunnel, because the tunnel is something that has never been seen before. You know, when I was trying to sell the idea to the televisions and all around the media and platforms, they all had the same answer. They said to me, oh, mighty, you know, enough of Syria. We have seen enough documentaries of Syria. We are fed up of Syria and we know everything about Syria. And I say, no, you don't know everything of Syria, because the Baba Ammam massacre is something that has been silent. And everybody's talking about Aleppo and everybody's talking about massacres that happened before or after. But Baba Ammam is something that has been forgotten. And for me, it's very important because it was the first time that the people in Syria felt completely abandoned. And it was the first time where they realized that they needed external help. And this opened the door to the radicalization, because they opened the door to the Muslim Brotherhood, to Al-Qaeda, and later the Islamic State. So it was the beginning of something worse. So this is why I think they felt completely abandoned. And this is the importance of Homs and Baba Ammam massacre, that it was the beginning of something terrible that, 10 years later, right now, is still going on.
You've spoken about other groups like Al-Qaeda affiliates becoming involved. I'm interested to know when you saw the change in the conflict. Was that a gradual evolution, or was that something that happened very quickly?
Well, I think it was a conflict that started peacefully, and that was lasting like 1 year, 2011. And then in 2012, they realized in Homs and in Baba Ammam and creating this Free Syrian Army that they were in on their own. They didn't have any money. They didn't have any help from Europeans or Americans or very little. The international community was not going to help them. In the Security Council, China and Russia were blocking any resolution condemning the massacre of Baba Ammam. So they let themselves be helped by these external groups, the Muslim Brothers, the Al-Qaeda, later the Islamic State that came in. And all this made the conflict finally look like a war of terrorists against a state, which was a benefit of Bashar al-Assad, of course, who is still in power. And, they won the war because they won the war of the public opinion. They won this propaganda war, finally helped by Putin, because everybody's thinking now that it was a war between terrorists and radicals against Bashar al-Assad. So, but it wasn't like this at the beginning at all. It was a war led by students and normal people, a middle class and working class that wanted to have a better life. And they wanted to have all the opportunities. They wanted to change the injustice, social injustice. And they wanted to just have a better life. So it wasn't like this at the beginning. So now what we have is that the revolution died in 2012 in Homs. The revolution, and I mean the Arab revolution, because all the Arab revolutions died after Syria, because it was the proof that anything you can do, any people you can sacrifice, any of yours that is going to die is for nothing, because finally you're not going to achieve anything. Don't fight for freedom, because you are not going to achieve anything. This is the message that we had after Homs and after the Syrian war. So what we have now is Bashar al-Assad in power. Half of the population is displaced in Syria. Half of a million people have died. Bashar is the president of a destroyed country in ruins. And is the price that he has paid to stay in power, to sacrifice thousands and drive out half of the population. So I think he's the president of a destroyed country.
And ultimately, it's the Syrian people and democracy that suffers.
Exactly. I think democracy, it's something that we have to take care, and not only the Syrians, but the whole international community. I think that we have a big problem of propaganda right now. Because I'm a journalist, I'm always working with information. I think that we have to be aware that we have to show the truth and understand where is the truth. We are doing great efforts to prove that we can record things on the ground and these things are true. But we have to demonstrate that these things that we are recording right now in Ukraine are true. So we have seen this in Syria, this disinformation machine, and now in Ukraine, everything is being called into question. And this is very weird for us. I think the only solution is to continue working to ensure that the journalist is recognized as a credible source, you know, ahead of any tweet, video, reel, TikTok that can be sent from the war. I think people have to understand that journalists on the ground is committed to say the truth, to ethics. And this is why we have to tell to the audience, everything you can see in the social networks is not valid, you know. In these difficult times, we have to be responsible and the audience has to be responsible to seek the truth, to check and look for veracity, for a better democracy for all, to save democracy, I would say.
It's interesting because we often say that truth is one of the first casualties of conflict. And you've touched on the notion of propaganda, particularly in relation to Syria and now what we're seeing in Ukraine. Would you say that Syria was really one of the first conflicts that you've reported on where it became a particular weapon of war?
Well, I think propaganda exists since a long time ago, but now there are powerful engines like the social media. There are massive weapons of disinformation. In the Second World War, propaganda was made through the planes and, you know, with all these papers they sent on the ground, explaining other messages. Right now, we have these social media. And Syria, I think Syria was a very good experiment for the Putin regime. I think Russia is an expert right now on this. And they are showing that it's a very powerful engine, because if you have the control of the information right now, you can win a war. And that was not the case in the past. I think more and more, these new wars are not conventional wars like the Georgian-Russian war. They are called the wars of fourth generation. And in these new wars, intelligence, open source information, and social media information can help you to win much more than on the ground. So Russia in Syria helped a lot Bashar al-Assad and was a kind of experiment to see how they could win the war with information. And they did it. They did it because finally they won the war of terrorism versus state. You know, so finally they realize that in Ukraine they can do it too. So this is why I think Syria was a different conflict. They had 10 years to do the experiment, to work with these new tools of information, social media, Twitter and WhatsApp and all these messages that can reach people and make you think emotionally what you feel about the war.
Certainly from my perspective as a lawyer, looking at the Syrian conflict, I think one of the fundamental differences in propaganda and disinformation was that it started to come from more legitimate sources, from academics and from those individuals. I mean, one person who's always discussed when you talk about propaganda in both Syria and now Ukraine is Vanessa Beely, who has been a powerful advocate for Syria and Russia. When you have that level of propaganda and disinformation coming from individuals who otherwise appear to be credible, how do you as a professional deal with that level of disinformation, particularly in a situation like Syria?
Well, for me, it was a matter of going on the ground and asking directly to the people what was going on. I mean, my only tool as a war reporter is go there and talk directly to the people and, you know, and report about what I'm watching, not about data that people is telling me that I cannot verify. So for me, my tool is to go there on the ground, talk to the people and write about the specific story. What we have to do is to explain the whole picture. But if you cannot, because maybe you cannot be in Damascus at the same time as Homs, at the same time as Aleppo, my mission is to explain what I'm watching, to be a witness. And this is what I'm explaining to you. I was there that day at that time and I saw that. And this is true. Why? Because I saw it. Some of my colleagues cannot believe me. I have a senior colleague living in Lebanon, very good friend of Damascus regime. And he said to me that the massacre in Homs never happened. And even if he saw my film, he would say to me that this massacre never happened because he's convinced by the propaganda. I can do anything about that. Intellectuals writing books saying that Bashar al-Assad is Mohammed Gandhi is very scary. But, you know, that gives me more strength to continue to do my work and to continue to tell the truth.
I think that's right. And it's something that we've experienced as well with our own investigations and having discussions with colleagues is that sometimes you're just not going to convince people that what is happening on the ground is actually happening on the ground. I mean, very similar. We've heard stories as Assad being the savior of Christians, for example. And we've seen how he has targeted all groups who have opposed his rule. But it is very difficult when you're constantly battling against the ownership of information. Do you feel that the best way to deal with that is just to report the story on the ground, to show the reality? And do you think that's enough?
Well, I feel this is my job. And after to defend and to show and to distribute my work around and keeping talking about, because, for example, nobody talks about Syria right now. So I have to keep talking and to keep showing 10 years after in the anniversary of the Baba Amr massacre. And it is enough. I don't know. I think it's my part of the story. For example, you guys, you're doing a great job trying to find proofs, you know, trying to talk to other people, civilians there on the ground, and to find any other proofs beyond my images. The only thing I can do is to film, is to shoot, to explain, to talk, and to write down on a book what I've seen. What can I do else? It's trying to talk to you, for example, and try to help you put in contact people that has been in prison, that have seen things, and trying to bring those perpetrators to the tribunals, which is not my job. but if I can help, I can give you any proofs. This is for me. For me, I'm super happy, and I'm very happy, and I feel that I'm doing something to help those victims.
You've actually partly answered my next question, which was, how do you get the evidence to prosecute these individuals? And what level of collaboration is there between journalists and other organizations? Do you see that that's a changing role for war reporters now because of the nature of the conflicts that we're now experiencing?
Yes, I think that we are more and more committed to be listened, because more and more we feel that we are not being listened, because there is a lot of noise in the social media. There is a lot of noise with this fake news. There is a lot of noise coming from intellectuals writing down political ideas that comes from different groups, and they are paid. Some of them are paid by those groups. So we are seeing this. Many of those groups are think tanks and NGOs. I think we are compromised right now to talk. We are compromised to be listened as a credible source beyond social media, beyond intellectuals. We have to be again the journalists that we were in the 20th century. I mean, journalists that can be credible. And how we can do this? I mean, we are more and more in contact with you, with lawyers, with NGOs, with people that believe in conflict resolution and in accountability. All my colleagues that have been in Syria, we are talking very often about how we feel frustrated that nothing happened. Bashar al-Assad is still there, still in power, a war criminal. So more and more, we feel the necessity, the need for us to do something beyond journalism and beyond writing, do something and saying, hey, all these people died there for nothing, and these guys are still out of prison and nobody is doing
anything. So this is why me and other colleagues, we are more and more trying to be in contact with lawyers, with people working in accountability, very courageous people that even after years and years and years, you continue to work and fight for justice. So yes, I think there is a big commitment now among us, especially senior correspondents covering especially the Syrian war, because we feel this anger inside. We feel this frustration that nothing happened, people died, and Bashar al-Assad is still in power and nothing happened to him.
I share your same frustration alongside Al Moderna at Guernica. We've worked on Syria for the past 10 years at least, and it is incredibly frustrating. But one of the questions I had, and you may not be able to answer this, but I would be interested if you can. When you talk about the frustration of all these people who have died, half the pre-war population have been forced out of their homes, and we don't see any real action at the international level. And then we see the response in relation to the conflict in Ukraine. How do you reconcile that? But why have we had such a greater response to the conflict in Ukraine than what we ever saw in Syria?
Well, I think that, again, social media and also European media played the propaganda of our governments. I was very shocked when I listened at the beginning of the war, European leaders talking in a very, very radical way that I've never seen or listened before when Syria happened. For me, it was very shocking. And I said, why? Why this reaction? I never listened anything like this against Bashar al-Assad. And he was committing crimes in the same level as Putin now in Ukraine. So I was shocked. Later, I talked to one of my best friends in Andalusia, and she said to me, we are doing a crowdfunding to send a bus to help Ukrainian people and to bring them here to San Fernando in Cádiz. And I asked myself, oh, wow, she's living close to the Gibraltar, you know, Strait. She's closer to Africa, and she's watching people dying in the coast every day. Why is she thinking about going to Ukraine to save the Europeans? It's because of media and propaganda. Because we make emotions through social media, the messages and the narrative made in social media that were coming from our states was very, very strong. And people have something that I say in Spanish, empatía inmediata, huh? Immediate empathy. You know, it's like this empathy is passing, like it's an empathy that can last the time of the news. They are really, really, really cross because they see people dying for a half an hour, but they forgot about it. And the Ukrainian war is the same. If they see it in television, they care. If they don't see it at television, they don't care at all. And this is something that we are watching more and more right now in our times. It was something, a phenomenon happening 10 years ago, but is deteriorating. I think it's something that these emotional messages are being perfectionated and they are reaching their goals. People are being manipulated so easily. This is what I think. And unfortunately, people don't feel the same with Syria, with the Africans, with the Venezuelans.
One of the points that you made is that our attention span is somewhat limited. Do you see that what's happened in Ukraine over the last couple of months has taken a focus away from the situation in Syria to the benefit of Assad? Do you see that when you have a situation like in Ukraine, that it does take the focus away from, let's say, Syria and situations like that and Yemen?
Of course, totally. It's not only Ukraine. The COVID was on the focus for a couple of years. People was scared. Then after Ukraine, because the war is coming to Europe, people is scared. There is an objective behind all of this. It's like people has to be scared anyhow, because like these people can be managed and can be manipulated. And this is, I mean, it's not me saying this. It's a big theory behind this of propaganda that I learned at university. I mean, if you want to
to manipulate people, make them scared. And you're going to have people scared. And for example, here in Spain, they are telling us that because of the war, you cannot buy this or this in the supermarket. You're paying more for the gas. But that happened before the war. They are lying to us. So what I think is happening is that the media are playing what the states want us to play. And journalists can have to become independent from this media that have become the actors of economical powers and political powers. And, you know, independent journalism is more needed than ever because it's in danger.
We can say now, for the first time in 50 years, Nobel Prize being awarded to a journalist persecuted and beaten by a political regime of our own country. What's changing?
Well, I think that what is changing is that we are becoming aware that the control of the information is very important right now. And we have to fight, as I do, for example, in Reporters Without Borders, to stop, for example, the killing of journalists, because 90% of the killing of journalists remain unpunished. I think we have to keep working to find the perpetrators of the killing of journalists and, of course, of the civilians and to bring them to justice. But, you know, journalists have to be protected. And we need to protect journalism because it's one of the more important actors for democracy. Without an independent journalism, democracy is also in danger. So we need to ensure that we have an independent journalism in order to have a very healthy democracy in Europe. This is the first thing we have to do. And for this, we have to fight to have at least journalists protected and journalists alive and journalists that can be secure in a conflict zone. This is very important.
Absolutely. My last question would be, what's next? What's next for you?
I think next thing is to bring this documentary all around. Right now, it has been shown in Spain and in Al Jazeera, in the Middle East and North Africa. My aim is to show this to more open audience, in a global audience. I want to bring this film to festivals, to cinema, and to leave it as a book, you know, for the generations coming, to know that these things happened, this crime against humanity happened in Baba Amr. And I haven't been in Ukraine, but I want to go there. Or maybe my next step is to go to Russia, because I'm feeling that the Russian people is not being listened. Lots of Russians are feeling very bad about the Ukrainian war. So my next step is to travel to Russia, finally, to talk to them, even to the people pro-Putin, because it's very interesting to listen what is going on in Russia. It's a very interesting country. I love Russians. And I recommend everyone to listen and to read everything, not only European media, but also Americans, but also Russians, and also Al Jazeera's and, you know, Middle East media, because only like this we can understand the whole picture.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think it is an incredibly ambitious next step, but I certainly hope you do it. I would like to thank you for your time. It's been absolutely amazing talking to you. I think the world is a much better place having people like you in it. And I hope you continue what you're doing.
Thank you so much. I say exactly the same to you. Thanks, you guys, to do the job you do. It's amazing. Congratulations. And thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Well, look, let's make the world a better place together.
Let's do it.
We've just listened to Maite Carrasco in our new podcast. And it's not only relevant to show the depth and importance of her work and the still very much pending accountability in Syria, but it also exposes a systematic problem. And this is something that she touched upon. And it's the alarmingly growing systematic attacks, killing them, of journalists doing their work. This complete disregard for the public value and dimension of having professionals who can tell us what's happening, the truth. Guernica 37 has a serious commitment to this issue. We've worked for many years with organizations, civil society groups in Latin America, South Asia, the Middle East and North Africa to expose this problem, because this is not exclusive to Syria. It intensified there for sure, but we're now seeing it also in Ukraine. And for the first time, war correspondents have become the targets. Guernica 37 recently participated as prosecuting counsel in the People's Tribunal for the Murder of Journalists, a civil society-driven effort aimed at deepening and exposing precisely this problem. The tribunal studied three cases: Mexico, Syria, and Sri Lanka. Three countries where being a journalist became a grave risk. It became the most dangerous profession. There is a shift in the value of the truth and the consideration of those who are committed to keeping it alive. For that reason, the Guernica 37 Accountability Podcast opens with this podcast, a series focused on the work of these brave professionals. Exploring deeper the Syrian situation, we will be next interviewing war photographer and journalist Paul Conroy. And following on from that, we will be interviewing the French journalist and broadcaster Edith Bouvier. If you enjoy these podcasts, as we hope you do, please do follow the series on our website and feel free to post on social media with any comments you have. You can find our website at www.guernica37.com, where you can find more details about what we do and find all of the podcasts in our series. You can find us on Twitter at the Guernica 37 Group. You can also find us on Instagram, LinkedIn, and Facebook. We hope to continue to bring you interesting accounts from around the world. I'd like to thank you for listening. This is the Guernica Accountability Podcast. Until next time, thank you and goodbye.